another beautiful day in paradise, and I'm talking with one of the Rockefellers. Imagine what it's like to grow up when somebody is saying, who do I look like? A Rockefeller? What do you think? Anyway, Eileen is on the line. Good morning, Eileen Rockefeller.
Good morning, Rhett Palmer, the mayor of the airwaves. I've never met a mayor of the airwaves before.
Well, now you have my child. Now you have my child.
I'm very impressed.
And we have something in common. We both love to spend time up in Maine in the summer.
Yes, that's true. I just learned that from you.
Yeah. Now
it's
she's
a great place to be.
Oh, it is. Acadia, and of course, didn't last year actually? I think I took a tour of the Acadia Park, and the whole top section is still owned by the Rockefeller family, right?
Well, it is, and you might have even, if you saw a carriage with two horses pulling it, it might have been me.
Oh, wonderful.
Because I drive my pair of Morgan horses around there.
Ah, wow, that sounds like fun. What a beautiful...
52 miles of trails, that the carriage roads that my grandfather personally laid out back in the 30s, and hired people during the Depression to build the roads, which he later gave to Acadia National Park.
Yes, your family has been kind enough to let folks like me take those rides.
Well, everybody ought to be able to enjoy them.
Yeah. Now, growing up, you've written this book, Being a Rockefeller.
Becoming Myself, let's not forget that part.
Yes, that's the subtitle's the most important.
I don't know which was harder, Being a Rockefeller or Becoming Myself, but... they both have their challenges, as does anybody have the challenge of becoming themselves, no matter what family we come from.
Well, it's got to be tough. Just the other day, I was with Wayne Huizenga Jr., and, you know, his dad sold Blockbuster for $8 billion, and Wayne Jr. and I have become friends, and I was talking to him. I said, you know, it's got to be tough, you know, because everybody thinks you've got all this money, and everybody's got to constantly be hitting you up. Did you find that to be your life also?
Well, yes, that was definitely still is part of my life. But I think the other fallacy is that people will think that if you have money, then you must have happiness. And unfortunately, that's kind of a myth that's perpetuated over the media today, that money is the way to happiness. And I won't deny that a certain amount of it, so that you can have food on the table and good shelter, is essential, but needing a television in every room or the latest gadget or the latest clothes, to me, that is where the myth goes awry, and it becomes actually counterproductive for people, because, in fact, it's not about net worth that makes the difference. It's about self-worth. Do we feel we have a sense of self-worth? Because that's where our happiness comes from, is knowing that we are worthy within ourselves and knowing that we're loved. I think the greatest tragedy of life is if one were to die before knowing they're loved.
Well, Eileen, first of all, I'd like to applaud you and commend you, because I think that your message is very important at this very time. Because so many, in the days of old, people would do something that was worthy of becoming famous or wealthy for. And usually by going through the trials, the character would be etched in them by having to climb that mountain. Whereas now, young people today, they all just want to be famous. And you grew up as...
I know, for famous' sake, as if that's the goal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a very important message, and you've been given the power by your circumstance and the legitimacy, the credibility to say that. You grew up as one of the youngest of six children in four homes. They employed over 100 people, and yet you deliberately raised your two children differently. Expound on that, would you?
Yes, well, and actually my mother raised us somewhat differently, too, because we had a farm to go to in the summers, and we had every kind of farm animal, and adopted an orphan deer one time, and we had raccoons and crows. So we had an unusual life, and that part of it I did transmit to our sons when we took 5 months when they were 8 and 10 to homeschool them on our farm in Vermont. We weren't at that time living there. We were living in San Francisco. But we came back for 5 months and did what we called an experiment in simple living, framing it in the time period of the 1840s and We had projects in the areas of food, shelter, clothing, and community, the four basics of life. And we grew all of our own food and made our own butter and candles and sheared sheep and spun and dyed wool and wove. We wrote a poem. I mean, we did so many projects. We ate outside. This part was actually going back further than the 1840s. We didn't have a wood stove, which they would have cooked on at that time. But we ate under a tripod with a chain and a kettle and cast iron frying pans. And we used the Laura Ingalls Wilder cookbook for our reference.
Really?
It was great fun. That was 5 months of our lives. And then, you know, years later when they were writing their college applications, I asked them each, why didn't you write about the project in Simple Living? Wasn't that pretty amazing and unusual? And they said, well, not really. It wasn't that much different from the other summers. Because we always gave them free range to make up their own entertainment. We would never be letting them be playing computer games, video games, or watching TV. They were out in the workshop with the American Boys Handbook. I don't know if any of the listeners know of that, but that is, there's also an American Girls Handbook.
Yeah, I perused them both at the bookstore. Yeah, those are pretty interesting books.
Oh, my
books.
Gosh. They are so much fun. We built rafts. They learned how to, our younger son learned how to blacksmith and actually became a very serious artisan blacksmith and worked at Colonial Williamsburg years later. And our other son carved birds out of wood and, oh, just wonderful projects, became a banjo player. So I guess we've raised them in unconventional ways, but they're ways that use their hands and their heart as well as their head.
Well, it's got to be very, very, you know, those who are born with privilege that I have known in my life have reared their children knowing the work ethic. You know, a friend of mine, $500 million, yet they people would know they had that. They run a little restaurant. They run a little place down here, and they also have a place on Nantucket. And he's always got his chef's apron on. And I said, why do you do this? He said, because we want to rear our children knowing the work ethic.
Right. Well, that's one of the messages that I hope people will glean from my book and from reading the numerous, I think there are something like 45 chapters of just plain stories talking about our time growing up, building a prefabricated cabin on an island in Maine and cruising the islands. But my mother really wanted to make sure we understood what it was like to do real work. And both my parents treated everyone with respect, whether they were the chauffeur or the butler or a taxi driver or a king.
What do you do, though? Because I have a friend of mine who was flying back from doing an interview with the governor recently, and he has he has an exceptional amount of money. And I said something came up about his son. He said, well, I can't leave this. I can't give all these hundreds of millions of dollars to my son. It would ruin his life. And I would think that you know, Bob Dylan has a line in one of his songs, excuse me, help me, I'm helpless like a rich man's son. How do you know whether it's your family member or whether it's a stranger? There are times when it's good to give, and then there are other times where you can ruin a life. We know that most lottery winners end up divorced and suicidal after a couple of years.
Well, I'm not sure which question you're asking me about, because the question about philanthropy or who do you know to give to or whether you should give to your children are different questions, but both require a certain amount of intuition and then really knowing who, in the case of children, knowing who your children are and giving them the proper guidance so that when and if you do choose to transfer wealth to them, you're giving them the guidance to go along with it. I mean, my grandfather had written a credo in stone at Rockefeller Center, and part of it, which has always stuck in my mind with a sense of burden as well as responsibility, is it goes like this, every opportunity implies an obligation, every right a responsibility, every possession a duty. Well, that's a pretty heavy load to carry around, but I would rather be given such an expectation than no expectation at all, which is, I think, the problem that many people with wealth, they just don't know maybe how to communicate their values. Maybe they're not clear on what their values are.
Mm-hmm.
But we transmit values whether we're clear about them or not.
Well, noblesse
oblige.
One
of the best ways is when we're sitting around the dining room table. But sadly, so many parents today don't even have meals with their children.
Yeah, that's terrifying. Noblesse oblige, the obligation of nobility. One thing, though, about your grandfather's legacy is I was told that John Rockefeller was, of course, a committed Christian in that from the very beginning, whatever he would make, he tithed 10% back.
Yes, John D. Rockefeller Sr. was that way, absolutely. And he believed that the wealth that he received was that which he was meant to, but it was also that he was meant to find ways to improve the world.
Do you go out, is it hard for you to go out incognito and sort of in a clandestine fashion and just be in the ranks and maybe give your time to a local charity so you can get the pulse and the feel of being, out in public? Or
well, happily, I'm not that well known. If I were my father, that would be a lot harder. My father is David Rockefeller,
uh-huh.
And pretty much wherever he goes, even now at almost 99, he's recognized. He's blessedly in good health.
That's amazing.
But, I don't have that issue. I'm very clear with my husband on our philanthropy. We give primarily to stopping climate change. And so we have a very strategic program and have been working on that since 2007. And I'm not the kind of person who gives just, I think it's very important that people give to hospitals and we give a certain percentage to local causes every year, to about 100 different local causes, but small amounts, $100 to $250. That's sort of what we feel is our community obligation, and we're very happy to do that. And then our major focus is in stopping coal as the greatest offender of climate change, because 40% of carbon dioxide is created by coal.
All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back. Okay, Eileen?
Okay, thank you.
We're talking with Eileen Rockefeller, and the title of the book is Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself, a memoir. And I think it's a very important message that she is coming out with this book at this time, because there's such an adulation, an overt desire by with young people for fame and fortune. And instead of the character that builds, that we all need to have a happier life, that money alone and fame alone cannot make for happiness. We'll be right back. This is the Mayor of the Airwaves. Today's broadcast brought to you by Indian River Medical Center. We'll be right back.